Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is Megan B. Murphy. Megan is the author of the new book, Your Fully Charged Life, which we do a deep dive to in today's episode. Megan has an incredible backstory and her reason for writing the book based on her mess becoming her message and using some of the adversities she's had in life to make herself mentally stronger. So in today's episode, we talk about how she recovered from an eating disorder and healing her relationship with food. We also dive into positive psychology and a lot of the stories and techniques and tools that Megan has in her book, things from checking in at checkout and asking what people are doing right and then mimicking them. So basically copying what they do so that you can get similar results. We also talk about chasing what excites you and how to listen to that voice inside, learning to say no and how it's a form of self-care and not doing things out of a sense of obligation and everything in between. Today's episode is going to resonate with you if you are anyone who is struggling to live a fully charged life and get your mindset right. Megan is, by her own admission, inherently not a very positive person and had to rewire her mindset over the years. And her book and the podcast today expands on some of those tools that she used in order to do that. We also talk a lot about fitness in today's conversation because of her background in fitness and healing herself and healing her relationship with food and recovering from an eating disorder. So there's a lot in today's episode. So I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed recording it. Now, so without further ado, here is today's podcast episode, Megan Murphy, on recovering from an eating disorder, learning to say no, and living a fully charged life. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Megan B. Murphy. Megan is a lifestyle and health expert, influencer, podcaster, a home hack master, mother, and certified trainer. She is also the author of the new book, Your Fully Charged Life, which we will be doing a deep dive into on today's podcast. Your Fully Charged Life is a high energy guide to living with presence, optimism, and joy one year at a time. It goes through everything from cultivating gratitude and making meaningful connections to learning to say no and recharging when you need it. I'm looking forward to talking all things mindset and how to live a fully charged life in today's episode. Megan, welcome to the podcast.
Yay. You know, I say that a lot, right? It's my favorite word. My husband jokes that we should turn it into a drinking game.
It's so funny because just to give people a little bit of a backstory, this is our second attempt at the recording just because of internet connections between Ireland and the States. And every time we've had a conversation from this Skype interview to DMs to emails, there's a yay in there somewhere. So it's definitely your word that I associate with you.
Right. It's like my mantra. It's my little lightning bolt. It gives me a jolt.
I love it though, because it gives you that, it's that positivity on the front end. Like one of the things that I vibed off you straight away, and it was our mutual friend, Kim Constable, who introduced us. And I was like, oh, she's positive. I was like, I like your vibe. I'm digging this, Megan. So before we kind of do a deep dive into your book and into positive charge and taking charge and then everything that goes with living a fully charged life, talk to us a little bit about your backstory.
Yeah, I think it's kind of crazy because I trained to live this way. Like the same way I've trained for a marathon or I trained to see my abs again after having three kids, I trained to live with optimism and joy. I am an inherently negative person. My nickname was Grumpy as a kid. And people who only know me now find that impossible to believe. And people who know me from my childhood and my past can't believe the transformation that I've undergone. And so that's the first thing I want to put out there. I am not naturally fully charged. I am not naturally positive and optimistic. I have absolutely trained to live this way. And it wasn't that hard. You just need the tricks. And that's exactly what the book outlines for you. But like my nickname was Grumpy as a kid. I wore a necklace with a grumpy charm. I was angsty. I was sullen. I was miserable. And all of those big, scary feelings translated to a raging eating disorder. You know, I starved myself to quiet all of those emotions, all that negativity, all of that overwhelm, all of those big emotions that I couldn't really process. I wound up with a raging eating disorder. And I'm good at things. So I was good at being anorexic. I wound up, you know, passing out on a soccer field, being rushed to the hospital. And my best friend was going through a similar thing. And her parents and my parents were friends. And she, you know, called me in my hospital program. It's like, okay, I'm on my way too. My parents are checking me in. How bad is it? I'm like, it's not that bad. Get here. We'll get through it. And tragically, she jumped out of the car and died en route to the hospital. So very surreal teen years for me, very tumultuous, very surreal. You know, I'm battling with an eating disorder, being hospitalized, you know, working through a program, starting therapy, dealing with the guilt of any role I had in my best friend's death, and also the first loss I've ever really experienced. You know, I was 16 and it was this major loss. I'd never been through anything like that before. And I talk about that adversity because that was a big turning point for me. I decided to make my mess my message, and I wrote about it. So writing and expressing myself has always been a powerful therapeutic tool for me. And in writing about that experience and moving through that loss and that tragedy, I wound up earning a $10,000 college scholarship and being featured on a you know, primetime special here in the States as a celebrated scholar. And that kind of springboarded a magazine career for me. So from having gotten that attention, I wound up, you know, YM Magazine, which is, you know, was young and modern at the time. It rest in peace, it no longer exists, but they wanted to tell my story. And I said, great, I'll write it and I'll start on Monday. I'm going to be an intern. Cause at that point I was fearless, right? Like, I've been hospitalized. I've lost my best friend. I'm like, okay, I'm afraid to ask for an internship. Hardly. So I showed up, and that was the beginning of a 25-year magazine career.
I love it. And then again, I'm going to double back on a few things there about being an inherently negative person, the eating disorder, adversity, all of these things that I'm going to touch on today. But talk about the book then. This is obviously a culmination of the way that you live now, and you're putting it across for people so that they can go from being potentially a negative person themselves, or thinking in a negative way, or having negative thoughts, which is something we all have, to flipping the script with that and being a lot more positive. What was the idea for the book, or why now? What was the...
Yeah. Wow. Brian, so this was not like, oh, and then I got positive. So it's a pretty long journey. I wound up eventually being an editor at Cosmopolitan magazine. And, you know, I was still kind of angsty and sullen. I was a functioning human. I had kicked the eating disorder. So I was like, you know, learning to treat, you know, food as fuel and movement as medicine. And I was no longer punishing or torturing my body. And I was in a much better place with the eating disorder and my relationship with my body. But I was still kind of a miserable, negative, glass is always half empty kind of person, which not a super fun way to live. And as an editor at Cosmo, I was assigned a story to write called The Seven Secrets of Happiness. And I definitely rolled my eyes, like I was an ace eye roller, rolled my eyes at my boss and was like, yeah, oh yeah, who wants to read that crap? But that was the assignment, right? So I started to do some research, and I looked at the field of positive psychology, and I started to look at neuroscience, and I discovered the work of Martin Seligman, who's like the godfather of positive psychology. And I was fascinated. I was so fascinated that happiness was not like this bumper sticker bullshit that I had known, right? Don't worry, be happy. That was like the eighth, like when I was in eighth grade, that song was super popular. Don't worry, be happy. Like, how the hell do you do that? Oh, okay, great. I'll just be happy. Like, it was just a horseshit to me. Like, okay, great bumper sticker. But it was in writing that piece that I understood that you could be happy if you learn to do happy. Right? Because happy is not this passive state of being. It is an active state of doing. And there are very strategic, science-proven things that inch you forward, that move the happiness needle. And when you start to learn what they are and you start to do them, you start to live differently. You start to live lighter. You start to live with more hope and more positivity. And when shit things happen, you move through them more easily. And so that's where the seeds of A Fully Charged Life started to get planted. And then I went on to Self Magazine, and I was the fitness director there. So I've been a certified trainer for like 17 years, and I've made exercise videos with the likes of like Jillian Michaels and Shaun T and Tone It Up. And I was the fitness director there for 9 years. And that's where I was working on the self challenge. So I coached, you know, hundreds of thousands of people how to live their best lives, how to, you know, treat movement as medicine and how to eat for energy and how to reach their soul goals and stay motivated. And I loved that, right? And in the process of that, I was trying all these tricks and tips and strategies out on myself, using myself as a guinea pig, understanding what made people feel good and help them live their best lives. You know, and I was living with so much more positivity. I had a lot of strategies in place, was really kind of working on some of these positive psychology tools and tips and tricks and training to live differently. And good things started to happen. I wound up marrying my brother's best friend, and I wound up having 3 kids, you know, and then moved to the suburbs, had a house with a swing set. And at that point, I moved on to Good Housekeeping magazine as the executive editor for 6 years and became kind of a life hacker and like learning, you know, teaching and learning different tricks for helping people, you know, problem solve MacGyver style. And then in that moment, unfortunately, life bitch slapped me a bit again. And my father, who I just adored, who was my biggest cheerleader and fan, was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And he was gone in 5 months. And that rocked my world. I had 3 little kids at the time, and it was just hard. And I can remember sitting with him in chemo one day, and he's getting pumped with this chemical cocktail, and he's in this green leather recliner, and I had picked up lunch and we're sitting there, and I was like, Dad, I got to have a hard conversation. I haven't given up hope. I love you with all my heart, but like, how do you want to be remembered? Like, what's your legacy? And he was very, very clear about how he wanted to be remembered and what that legacy was. And in that same breath, I asked myself the same question, and it became overwhelmingly clear for me that I wanted to leave a legacy of positive energy, that I wanted to teach people and share with people the toolkit that I had established to weather hard times, like my father being diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Like, that sucked, but I had the tools to move through it with grit and grace. It didn't mean it didn't suck, and it didn't mean it wasn't hard, but I had the tools, and I wanted to share those tools with others. And so it was in that moment where I sort of said out loud, and I think that's the first step in any dream, is being brave enough to say it out loud. I want to write this book. I want to write a book. I want to share these tricks and tips and strategies. And then I was determined. You know, I lost him a few weeks later, and I was on a mission. I was on a mission to get this book done.
And it comes across in the way that you've structured it, in the stories that you tell. And I love that that's where it came from, in terms of, you know, leaving a legacy. It's very much as your mess becoming your message. It's one of the hardest things that happens in life. And it's like, well, how can I make something good come from this? And if it's the clarity of I need to leave positive energy behind me, then I think it's for the greater good in the way that you mm-hmm. see that. You mentioned happiness as an action there. And I love that, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions around happiness, that, you know, the happiness fallacy is what I call it, that I'll be happy when, you know, I meet my dream person. Or I'll be happy when
I get happy a new if.
Yeah, like that fallacy that is just this hamster wheel of going round and round and round. But you mentioned it there as an action. Is the first step towards that taking charge?
Exactly. It's deciding that you want to live differently. And I always liken it to an exercise habit, right? Like, if you have never had movement or exercise as part of your life, you don't actually understand what you're missing, right? And it's like the first time you get that exercise high, because the sun is shining and you're getting that vitamin D and the wind is in your hair and your face, and you've just like, you know, walked or run, you know, a 5K. And then you're like, I want to do that again. That felt good. Right. It's the same way living with positivity, prioritizing positivity, choosing happy, doing happy. Once you get a taste of how much better that makes life's hard times and how much it's just an easier, nicer way to live, you kind of get hooked and you establish a habit. You establish a happiness habit the same way you establish an exercise habit. And just in the same vein, there'll be days when I wake up and I'm like, oh man, it's 5 a.m. I'm not really dying to go for that run. What can I do to think differently, to do differently, to re-energize, to get myself motivated to do that?
So let's pull it back for a moment. You talked about starving yourself to quieten those noises in your head and use the language a raging eating disorder. Talk about your eating disorder and how did you overcome that? You mentioned therapy, but what did that process look like for you?
I'm a person who's good at things, right? And I was good at anorexia. I starved myself till I passed out on a soccer field and, landed in a hospital. And then my best friend's parents brought her to the hospital to join me, and sadly she never made it. She jumped out of the car en route to the hospital. And so here I am. You know, I'm 16 years old. I'm hospitalized for an eating disorder. I've just lost my best friend, the first person I've ever lost, the first real loss in my life. And I'm tasked with now overcoming this. So there was a lot of therapy. There was inpatient therapy. There was outpatient therapy. I was in and out of the hospital, you know, several times. And it was a long process of ultimately learning to appreciate food as fuel and exercise as medicine versus punishment, because I had this eat it, negate it mentality. So if I had a rice cake, well, then I would exercise for 4 hours to try to eliminate it. And it was a really debilitating, exhausting process. I you know, landed in the hospital for a reason. And it took me, you know, a lot of therapy just to become a functioning human, like what I like to say, a functioning human. I wasn't the fully charged person I am now, but I was beginning to function.
How did you rewire your mindset with food in terms of that food for function, food for fuel? What was your kind of process for that?
It was honestly a very long process, and it wasn't like there weren't setbacks in the process, because, you know, as an anorexic, I was like, I have diet orange soda, and then I have a diet Coke, and then maybe I'll have a diet fountain soda, and I'll wash it down with a rice cake and a spoonful of cottage cheese. I mean, I restrict it severely. And if I did eat it, then I would take laxatives or exercise for hours and hours and hours. And exercise wasn't fun. It was punishment for me. I mean, it was sort of like, uh-oh, you ate, now sweat it out. And it wasn't until I really began to understand that, well, movement is fun. It's mood magic. I feel better when I sweat. And I don't need to sweat to erase my breakfast. I need to sweat to erase my bad mood, to process my stress, to, you know, ease some anxiety. And once I began to slowly understand that, like, a strong body gave me a strong mind, a switch began to flip.
Is there something that you know now that you wish you had known back then? And I know it's a very long process in terms of changing the way you see things, the movement, the food, but is there anything in particular that you know now? And I say this because an eating disorder, again, I'm always hesitant to touch on it because there's everything from disordered eating to full-blown eating disorder, which is where you were at. But mm-hmm. Is there something that you wish you had known that you know now would have been very beneficial for you back then?
Yeah, I wouldn't have listened. Right. I was an angsty, miserable 16-year-old, and I wouldn't have listened. I don't think there was anything that would have gotten me through it except going through it. And I had to come out the other side. I had to hit rock bottom. And I think most addicts will tell you that. It's not until you really hit the lowest of lows where that you begin to understand, maybe there's a different way to live. Maybe there's a better way to live. Maybe this really, really sucks. I wouldn't have listened. And to your point, I think that most people have a challenging relationship with food and a challenging relationship with exercise and a challenging relationship with their body. I don't think it's easy for many people. And I love to surround myself with those. I have one or two friends where it's just, they just intuitively eat. They exercise because it feels good. And I just admire that. I mean, there's days even now when I struggle. My body's changing. I'm 45. There are days when I'm mad at it. And I understand that I have to treat it with grace and kindness because it's the only body I got, and I'm grateful it's healthy even when it doesn't cooperate. But I think we all struggle.
With that, when I think of your message, and you talked about earlier your mess becoming your message, and I think the eating disorder and the adversity and how it's made you grow as a person, what's your relationship like with adversity currently?
Well, it's so interesting talking about making your mess your message. So, you know, I moved through that eating disorder, understood that food was fuel and exercise was mood magic and medicine. And then I became a certified trainer. I've been a certified trainer now 17 years, but I became the fitness director of Self Magazine. I coached people for 9 years through the Self Challenge to learn how to be their best selves and to reach their own, you know, weight loss, exercise, diet, motivation goals. So I absolutely made my mess my message and then worked really hard to help others kind of change that mindset the way I did.
And with the book then, Living a Fully Charged Life, and we're going to unpack this more in a lot more detail, mm-hmm. but when you were writing it, what was the thing that you were hoping to achieve with it?
You know, I feel really grateful that I was able to change and that I'm able to live differently and that I'm able to prioritize positivity and really remain unflappable in most crap situations because I have this toolkit. And for me, the whole impetus for the book was being able to share that. I'm a service journalist, right? I've been a service journalist for 25 years. Like, my purpose and passion in life is helping others. I get that helper's high. And if I am an evangelist for information, so if I find something that works, oh my gosh, I want to shout it from the rooftops. That's just how I'm wired. I want to help. And so when I realized, when crap things happen to me, you know, my father's death, work getting COVID, I have this toolkit that helps me move through it with grace and it's okay. Oh my God, I have to share this. Like, as if it's working for me, it's going to work for other people. I'm always using myself as a guinea pig. And when it works for me, whoa, I want to share it with others. That's just how I'm wired. That's my purpose, is always in helping others.
When it comes to the toolkit, what is an example of some of the tools that you use?
So the thing I like to say is that living fully charged looks different for everybody. And the tools in each of our toolkits will be different. And so that's why your fully charged life, it's not a plan. It's not a program. It's a toolkit. And so what works for me is not necessarily going to be what works for you. It's going to be look different for everybody. And some of the things that work for me, you might roll your eyes at. And some of them, they might be your aha. And so what my book does, and it sort of looks like at the different aspects of your life. So it looks at the work charge. And if you're struggling in work, I'm going to give you strategies around that. The love charge, if you're struggling in your relationships, I'm going to give you tools around that. If it's you're going through loss and you're in a state of grief, I'm going to give you tools around that. So really, you can dive in wherever you're struggling or wherever you need that little lightning bolt of electricity to recharge and reboot. Some examples, you know, I make my bed. I make my bed every morning. 82% of bed makers say they feel more productive during the course of the day. They're happier during the course of the day because starting your day with that small sense of accomplishment tends to start this ripple effect of good things. I dress up to feel up. I call it dopamine dressing. I dress the way I want to feel. So I'm going to be in bright colors and happy makers. I might have a fun shoe that's a bit of a conversation starter or a really bold earring. You know, that looks different for everybody. My husband wears a suit, but then he'll have, you know, taco socks. You know, he's a party from the ankle down. What? How do you dress the way you want to feel? Understand that your clothes have power. Smile. Fake it till you make it. Just turning up the corners of your mouth sends these signals to your brain that everything is maybe not as bad as you thought. I buy myself a lot of flowers. There's really great Harvard research around the fact that having fresh cut flowers in your house can actually ease anxiety and boost your mood. Okay, well, I'm not going to argue with Harvard. That works, and it works for me. I am constantly got scissors. My neighbor just let me pick irises out of his yard, and I'm just like, ah, I'm so happy. Yay, fresh flowers. But it's all these little things that can ultimately have a big impact. And that's what's so cool about it. It's often not this life overhaul or this life makeover. There are small things that you could implement, that you could do today, that could make tomorrow more awesome. And it's not that hard.
Do you think when it comes to happiness and, say, living a fully charged life, that we have too much of a silver bullet mindset when it comes to that, as opposed to focusing on these small things that all add up?
I think that when we think too big, we can get stuck and then everything feels daunting, right? It's the same way with like weight loss or exercise. If you say to yourself, I want to run a marathon, and you've never run a mile, well, that's pretty daunting, right? I want to lose 30 pounds. We'll start with 1 pound. I think when we, you know, think small, we're able to have a bigger impact. And I think that's really what I'm saying here. It's not like, okay, this one big, giant, daunting, sweeping thing is going to change you or fix you or help you. What if it's one tiny thing that leads to one more thing, to one more thing, till suddenly you have this, like, you know, boomerang effect, this escalating effect of good stuff. You put yourself in motion, you create momentum around one little change, one little spark.
It's interesting because one of the things I connected with in the book and through our conversations is that goal setting process of, you know, starting small and working towards something, which is funny because for me, I found that it always is dependent on the goal. For something like a fitness goal that I feel super confident in, I have to set a massive goal for myself. in order, or else I can't get motivated to do it. Like when I signed up for my first marathon, it was, I signed up to run 6 through the Sahara because I wouldn't train for a marathon. Like,
of course,
it just,
you did.
Yeah, but in terms of personality type, I need to set that big goal because it's an area that I'm quite confident in. But in other areas where I struggle with, you know, when I was rewiring my and healing my food relationship, or, you know, with my partner and my personal romantic relationship, or with loved ones, these things that I struggled with initially, I was always on that side where I struggled with the people aspect. I was very good at achieving the external goals, but the people aspect was something I had to put a lot of work into. But I had to go small with those, because if I thought too big, I would just completely mindfuck myself to the point that I couldn't focus or do anything. So I think knowing yourself and understanding yourself is very important, based on should you go small, should you set the big goal. And it really depends on how much confidence you have in a particular area. When it comes to your personal life, Megan, what's your goal setting process? Is it always focusing on the small, or do you have to set them big, or is it a combination, or is it something completely different?
So it's interesting for me. So I always say I'm not much of a goal setter, but I am a goal getter. So I'm never really thinking big picture, because I often think if you worry too much about the what if, you don't really focus on the what is. So I'm somebody who's very, very present. So it's hard for me to project forward and to think about the next big thing. I'm always chasing what excites me and thinking small, yet I wind up doing bigger things. But I feel very overwhelmed by big, big goals. Like, so when I was going, you know, I run a couple marathons. It was more like, okay, what's today's run? What's today's track workout? You know, like, it wasn't like, okay, in 3 months from now, I need to be up to 26 miles. And but like, that's stressful to me. What can I do right here, right now? And it's not, you know, I understand that there's this bigger, loftier thing on the horizon. But when I focus too much on that, I'm completely overwhelmed. I need to stay in my day.
You talked about chasing what excites you. And I think that is such a, like, if there's one piece of advice you can give to anybody to kind of live a more fulfilled and charged life, it's, well, chase what excites you. But with that, I'm aware that it's also a very difficult thing to do, because there's a little bit of intuitive, you know, self-reflection needed in order to listen to that voice. How did you get better? And as somebody that has excelled in so many areas of life, from, you know, fitness to your profession, to your home life with your family, to the book, how do you cultivate, or how did you cultivate listening to that voice and learning to chase the things that excite you?
So I think a lot of it is that I'm grounded in gratitude. And that's very, very helpful to me when I appreciate things. And the more I appreciate things, the more I get excited about things. So I come at everything from a place of appreciation. And I find that, gosh, like when you truly are appreciative, you get a little excited. It's like a jolt, right? Like, wow, I am so grateful for this. And then next thing I know, I'm so excited about this.
How would you advise somebody get better with that? I've been a long-term subscriber. I think it's a Naval Ravikant quote that if you can't be happy with a coffee, you won't be happy with a yacht. But it's kind of learning to kind of take the pleasure in the small things. What would you advise for somebody who struggles with that? Because I know your book goes through this, but how would you advise somebody start with that, where they struggle with the gratitude mindset, or the attitude of gratitude, or gratitude attitude? What would you say to those people? Yeah.
Well, and here's the thing about gratitude. Like, I think it can be difficult to make a gratitude adjustment, because I think for many people we hear like, okay, I got to keep a gratitude diary and I have to have this gratitude practice. And it starts to feel like homework. It starts to feel like a lot. It starts to feel like one more thing on your to-do list. And for people who a gratitude diary works, like, I high five them. It never worked for me. I would do it for like a day and then it would be like, one more thing that I felt like I had to do. And trust me, I got enough to do. And so one of my strategies around gratitude was fun filtering it. How can I make practicing gratitude feel more fun? And so for us in my house, we say, what made you say yay today? And we will sit around the dinner table and before bed, what was your yay today? What made you say yay today? And that's absolutely a gratitude practice. My kids are pausing and I'm pausing to share the good that happened in the day, to pause and appreciate something exciting and yay worthy that happened in our day. but it doesn't feel homeworky. We don't have to get out the notebook. We don't have to get out the pen. We can be sitting around on Taco Tuesday and be like, you know what made me say yay today? The sun now comes up at 5:43 a.m. and I can run in the park instead of on a treadmill. Or like, the daffodils are blooming on Daffodil Hill. Yay! They're not going to be here very long. We got to appreciate them. What are those little things, you know? And that's a gratitude practice that feels less homeworky. Maybe that's something that would work for you, is just, you know, trying a strategy like that or reframing things. Like, I'm always telling people to change your have to's to get to's. That's an awesome way of practicing gratitude. You don't have to work out, you get to, right? You don't have to go to the gym. Wow, you get to, because guess what? The gyms are finally opening here in the States. Like, lucky you. I'll even do it around laundry. I don't have to do laundry. I get to do laundry because my kids got to play soccer after a year of being home, right? They got to play soccer. Oh my gosh, I am so happy they're sweaty and I have all this laundry to do. I get to do it because they got to play soccer. I mean, when you reframe things like that, that can also be a very helpful way to pause and appreciate and practice gratitude.
I love that. I think the have to's to get to's is such a powerful wordplay in terms of how you approach any situation. Like, you know, I have to go to the gym is completely different to I get to go to the gym, especially now with them reopening. Yeah. And it just completely flips your mindset.
And people will tease me like, oh yeah, you get to pick up dog poop? Yeah. Yeah, because I get to have a dog who I absolutely love and is like the cutest thing ever, right? Like, so yeah, I get to pick up poop.
Everything is everything is how we choose to see it. I think, right? That's definitely going to be the sound clip that we take for Instagram. No, I'm joking. That won't be our sound clip.
Calm down. It's all good.
Yeah. When you were researching the book, Megan, and you have a brilliant balance between the storytelling elements that you can obviously tell for people listening, the way that you're able to tell stories and interweave things mixed with the research, you know, a lot of the Harvard research and different research around happiness, fulfillment, etc. What was the most interesting research that you came across when you were going through and writing the book? Anything that jumped out at you that particularly stood out as an interesting point?
I'm fascinated by the field of positive psychology and I'm fascinated by neuroscience. And the thing I like, because sometimes people are like, positive psychology, what the hell is that? And like, what I love about positive psychology is it's a movement that's not that old. Martin Seligman is the forefather of positive psychology. And he was like the first person in the late 90s to look at the field of psychology proper and say, wait a second, we just look at what's wrong with people and kind of try to figure out how to fix them. What if we looked at what's right with people and tried to emulate that? And what a fascinating twist, right? It's like, let's look at what's right with people. Oh my goodness, let's do that. And let's try to emulate it. So all of his work is just so mind-blowing to me. Like, nobody was looking at that before. So I love all of his research. And I fun filter a lot of that. I'll give you lots of tips for cognitive reappraisal, which is basically reframing what's lame. You know, there's so many tips and tricks and strategies in this book. It's almost like picking a favorite child when I'm like, well, I really love this tip or I really love this strategy. The beauty is in the simplicity for most of it. I mean, just something as small as changing a have to a get to practice gratitude. You know, gratitude is absolutely one of the secret sauces in life. You know, grateful people are happier. That's a fact. Gosh, but it is definitely tricky for me to single out a single tip. Something I'm really passionate about right now is the Cheers effect and understanding the importance of our neighbors. And Cheers was a show.
No, it was a big show here too. Yeah.
It was a big show.
It was showing rage, but it was a big show. Yeah.
Right. I'm old, but that Cheers effect of, like, you know, going places where people know your name. And I'm trying very hard to start this whole movement called Check In at Checkout. And that's about, like, looking up and recognizing someone's humanity, using a name tag as a gift at the cash register, whether it's at the grocery store or the barista, and just making eye contact, smiling, engaging, recognizing someone's humanity, making someone feel seen and engaging in some way. Because I think it's been a lonely year for so many people and we don't know what other people are going through. And I think just, you know, engaging and recognizing people's humanity and feeling heard and seen is going to be super important for our mental wellness and health go forward.
Talk about check in at checkout. This is something, this is one of my favorite things from the book. And as you mentioned there, I love the Martin Seligman approach of what's right with people, you know, and try and emulate that. I think, you know, I've been a long-term subscriber to the Abraham Lincoln quote, or the quote that's attributed to him, that you learn from everybody you meet, even if it's what not to do. But in a lot of cases, yeah, you learn what you should do in the case of positive psychology. But this is one that I think is a very easy one for people to apply in a very, particularly now with the way the world is and moving out of pandemic, hopefully, and moving out of lockdowns. But talk about check-in at checkout.
So this is really sort of the power of weak ties. And researchers call them weak ties, which I think is almost like a misnomer because they're so powerful. But these so-called weak ties are, you know, an interaction or a relationship with someone sort of outside your family or outside your inner circle. So it's a cashier, it's a mail carrier, it's, you know, the person who checks you in at the gym, right? So these so-called weak ties, but they can be very powerful and they can spark this sense of community and connection and can really help us flourish, as researchers like to call, or thrive. And so that this whole checkout at checkout movement is really about pausing during those interactions, like, and engaging a little bit. And then I like to say, like, this doesn't mean you're going to go and braid the person's hair or have them over for a barbecue, but what if you just said hi? What if you said, you know, you're wearing that name tag? I became buddies with my grocery store guy, Ed, and now Ed and I basically hugged after we hadn't seen each other, air hugged after, you know, 6 months of lockdown, because, you know, I just missed that small interaction, that small pleasantry. How are you? You know, happy Tuesday. Like, what's going on for you? And just interacting with other people, looking up on your walk, you know, putting your damn phone down at checkout. How many times we're in line for coffee or we're buying groceries and we don't even look up, like, we have a damn phone. Put that away, engage, interact.
I'm actually going to double back at one point, but just because you brought up the phone there, and this is something that has been coming into my space quite a lot recently with different questions coming in from people on Instagram, podcasts, etc. What's your relationship like with your phone?
You know, my husband will tell me that I'm on it too much. And I agree with that, because now too much is on my phone. It's now, you know, it's my timer, it's my email, it's my calculator when I'm trying to help with third grade math. Like, it's too many things to me. It's my camera. And I wish it were fewer things, right? It's also my workout playlist. It's just too many things to me. You know, it's become like an extension of my hand, and I hate that. And so I'm very conscious of putting it down and calculatedly putting it down and hiding from it whenever I can, because I do think it's detrimental. I mean, we're all stuck in our phones instead of engaging with each other.
I use that, definitely connected with me in terms of making it fewer things. I've been trying to make that transition over the last few years. I don't do my email on my phone now for the same reason. I have to open my laptop. I have to turn on the internet. I have to actually go through a process to check my email.
And I just heard that. I think that's genius. I was talking to someone, or I was listening to a podcast where they put social media on an iPad, and only on the iPad. So, like, they could only do social media on the iPad. And guess where the iPad lives? On their office desk. Okay, so unless they're going specifically to their office on the iPad, social media doesn't exist. That's a great thing to do with email too. I mean, there's just too much on my phone.
But saving yourself from yourself, like, when it comes to your phone.
Yeah, sometimes you do. You have to trick yourself to help yourself.
Yeah, I love that. I'm definitely going to have some food for thought and reflect on that, just because I think, as you're wording there, make your phone, make be fewer things. I think that's very, a step back allows you to see that actually, if you're using it for everything, of course, you're going to be mildly addicted to it in the case of, you know, trying to change your relationship with it.
Right. I can't run without it. It's where I get my podcasts. It's where I get my Spotify. It's too many things to me. I'm completely aware of that. It's too many things to me.
Well, definitely after this podcast, I'm going to start thinking about ways that I can potentially go back and get a traditional alarm clock or a few other things like that jump to mind. When it comes then to living a fully charged life, Megan, talk about how important it is to learn how to say no to things, and the reason that it's very powerful to say no to things in your life.
Yeah. I consider myself an expert no-sayer. And I like to think of saying no as a form of self-care, just as important as, you know, getting in my workout or painting my nails or the other things that make me feel good. I need to be able to say no so that I can say yes to what matters, to say yes to what exactly excites me. Because I think when we experience burnout or we feel overwhelmed, it's because we're saying yes to things that don't light us up, that don't fulfill us, and not saying a no to enough of the things that don't fill us up. And so I'm very aware of that. If I say yes too often, then I'm not allowing myself the space and the freedom to do the things I want to do.
It reminds me, and I'm going to touch on how you talk about this in Fully Charged Life. In my first book, The Fitness Mindset, I have one of the processes for decision making is that it's either a hell yeah or it's a no. I'm like, yep. if your answer isn't, that's a hell yeah, I can't wait, there's a good chance that answer should be a no. What's your decision making process for what falls into the hell yeah or the yay category versus the no, this is actually going to take away from my energy, it's going to not leave me charged or recharged or whatever mm-hmm. it is. How do you separate, or how do you decide what you say yes and no to?
If I feel like saying maybe, I understand that it's a no. If there's any hesitation, I'm like, yeah, maybe. Oh, no, that's a no, right? So it can't be wishy-washy. I have to trust my gut instinct. And if my gut instinct is maybe, and I'm hemming-hawing even a little bit, that's a hard no. But what would I say yes to are things that, you know, kind of tie into my core values, like, Does it enhance my relationship with my family? Does it, you know, light me up in one of the key areas of my life where I'm excited about it and I'm happy about it and I want to do it? I give an example of the book as I said yes to counting these box tops. I don't know if you have box tops, but it's like these stupid little things for school that the PTA has. And I said yes to counting them because, you know why? I wanted to impress other moms to show like, yes, I'm this working mom, but I'm so involved and I volunteered to count box tops. Well, I completely forgot that I volunteered. Like the whole bag of these stupid cardboard things was in my mudroom, and I'm on my way to New York City and I get a text message from the mom like, hey, those were due this morning. Are you going to drop them off? And I'm like, oh, God damn it. I'm in New York City. I can't, like, there's no physical way for me to go count these pieces of cardboard. And I realized in that moment of like, I said yes to something that didn't matter. Because here's the thing is like, why do I give a shit what these other moms think? I actually only care about what my kids think. And it's not, so I said yes to something to impress other moms versus saying yes to something that was kid facing that would actually charge me up and bring me joy and connect me with my family. And so that was a lesson I learned very quickly. And now I say no to anything that feels like an obligation that isn't actually an obligation, right? Like, okay, I got to pay my taxes. That's an obligation that is actually an obligation, but like going to a birthday party for like the friend of a friend of a friend of a neighbor, that's not actually an obligation. So I can actually say no.
What do you think people struggle with when it comes to saying no? And the reason I ask that question is because so many times, and this is something I had to learn over the years, that I would say yes to things out of either a sense of obligation, similar to what you said, or I would be so worried what people would think if I said no, that you would just kind of default to yes and then be like, oh, fuck. You were like, oh, how do I get out of this? And you're then trying to find ways to get out of it or whatever you try and do. Why or what is the reason that people struggle so much with the no? Or what's the kind of step for kind of going from zero to one? For me, for example, it was not dissimilar to what you mentioned earlier, getting very clear on my core values, you know, what is important to me. And if it moves the needle in an area that's important to me, I'll say yes, and it's a hell yes, or it's a no. But it took me a while to get to that point. How would you recommend people who are struggling right now and know that their life would be better if they said no more often to the things that doesn't fulfill them or make them feel fully charged, what would you say for those people to allow them get from zero to one and kind of get off the ground with that?
Well, I think a big piece of that is, right, we're worried about hurting feelings or disappointing someone, but a half-assed yes is way more disrespectful, way less kind than a, you know, a wholehearted no. And I learned this even with my mom. Like, she wanted me to go see this stupid community thing, community theater. And it was a hard no for me. I was a theater major. I can't stand rinky-dink community theater. It makes me nuts. Like, I just want to tear my eyes out, and I can't stand it. So it's a hard no for me, but it's a no but. It's a no but, Mom. I want to spend time with you. I value you. I care about you, but I don't want to do this activity. What if we did this instead? Why don't we go to lunch and go shopping? That's something we both like to do, because the end goal is spending time together. Let's say yes to something we both want to do together, because what we want to do is spend time together. What I don't want to do is go see some crap community theater. And that's a kindness, right? Because am I going to go to this thing rolling my eyes, not looking forward to it, with a crap attitude because it's something I don't actually want to do? But big picture, I do want to spend time with my mom. I do care about my mom. So let's just be honest with each other and say yes to something that we both care about with this common end goal of spending time together.
I love that. I think that the no but, you get clear on what it is you want to do, get clear on the potential actions, or, you know, in the case of a theater, the things you don't want to do, and then just kind of decipher through it. So no but, I think that's incredible. And which kind of gives me a nice little segue, Megan, when it comes to the book, because it's been out now for a while and you're getting people that are messaging you, DMing you, I see it on your stories all the time. What has been the section or even the tip or the section or story even of the book that's been quoted back to you most often, or the one that people have messaged you the most about?
It's funny because the book clearly speaks to different people at all different ages and stages, and different chapters really resonate. A couple of my favorite things are from the extra charge chapter. People buy themselves flowers now all the time and send me pictures. I love seeing pictures of people's flowers, or they pick them in their yard and they bring them into the house. Because I do talk about harnessing flower power, and it's just such a small thing, but it has really resonated with people. People really seem to love dopamine dressing. People send me pictures and DMs of their outfits all the time now, dressing up to feel up. And I talk about, like, do you want your outfit to be a tranquilizer or a latte? And what does that look like? And the fascinating thing about power dressing is that all the research suggests it's what meaning you assign to the outfit, not the outfit itself. So your outfit, your power dressing, your dopamine dressing, dressing how you want to feel, could be sleek, head to toe black, or it could be loud, crazy emoji-esque patterns like me. But that looks different for everybody. And I love when people send me pictures of their outfits. I think that really has been super fun. And the work charge chapter has really resonated with a lot of people. And in the work charge chapter, I talk about focusing less on the what of work and more on the who, the why, and the how, and those relationships in the office, and how important it is to have that work wife or that work husband, and to cultivate friendships. People with friendships and camaraderie in the office are 50% happier and more productive. What does that look like for you? A lot of people are really resonating with the work charge chapter, which has been fun. It's different things stick for different people, and that's what I love about your fully charged life. I don't know what fully charged is going to look like for someone. And I love when they report back and we're like, this was the game changer. I decided to protect my sleep, and I sleep trained myself like I sleep trained my children. And guess what? I'm a new person. Like, that's amazing.
It's so true. The work charge chapter, I remember thinking when I was reading that back when I used to work as a primary school teacher, elementary school teacher where you are, my schools were all about who was around me, like, because I hated one of my jobs. And when I look back, I'm like, the job was the same. You're teaching 30 kids all the across yep. different curriculum, but it was the people. And I loved my last job. Like, when I left it, I left to start my own business. But I'm like, I loved the job because of the people. You know, you had mm-hmm. your work wife, you had your work husband, in the case of, like, I had my best friends that were working with me, and it makes all the difference. And that really illuminated that fact to me. It was something that I wish I had consumed back then, because I think I would have appreciated it more and had a bit more gratitude towards it as to why I was so happy in that place, because then you can mimic it in other areas. Exactly. If you switch jobs or you go other places. Megan, I just have one final question, and I highly recommend for everybody listening who are looking to take charge of their life, because your book is a toolkit. As you said, there's so many different things in here that people can apply, and it's very much a case of see what fits for you and then double down if it's working, and if it doesn't, discard it, move on to the next thing and try that. And I think your book gives people that in terms of getting their mindset right, using the positive psychology from the research that you've done, mixed and intertwined with your stories, that really allows to cement the messages that you're spreading. But with that in mind, I'm very curious, you've spoke to so many people now, you've been again on and achieving things for the past, you know, 20 plus years in terms of what you've been doing and setting goals and hitting them. But I'm very curious, if you had access to everybody on Instagram that is into personal development, that's into mindset, that's into potentially positive psychology or looking to improve their happiness or fulfillment levels, and you could give one message to those people, you literally had access to the Instagram world God, and they gave you access to everybody who was into positive psychology, happiness, fulfillment, or looking to achieve or lead a fully charged life, what's the one thing you would say to those people?
Oh, one thing. Oh, it's so hard to boil it down to one thing. I think that when you prioritize positivity, every day can be filled with yay.
Oh, I love it. What an amazing way to finish. When you prioritize positivity, every day it can be filled with yay. I love that, Megan.
Oh, good. Because that was, it was daunting, because there's so much in the book.
And you've summed it up perfectly, an absolute incredible way to finish off the podcast, because I think that synopsis tells you everything you need to know about the book. Megan, I've loved this conversation. We've chatted now a couple of times. I know we met through Kim. I know you were chatting to my friend Marcus on Inner Fight podcast. So you're doing the rounds
Marcus
on podcast.
Marcus is awesome. We talked yesterday.
I love Marcus. He's one of my favorite people. Like when I think
I knew
of,
it.
I knew you'd get on. I knew you'd get on because like you're both very no bullshit.
Other.
Yeah. Just say it as it is. I knew you'd connect really well. But Megan, for everybody listening, where is the best place for them to connect with you? Is it on Instagram? Is it through picking up the book where they can pick that up? Any links that you want to give now, please give them, and I will link them in the show notes for today's episode.
So I'm busy on Instagram at Megan B. Murphy. You spelled all crazy, M-E-A-G-H-A-N B. Murphy. I also do something called the Yay List on Instagram, which is just a place to share good news and positivity. Now, my book is on Amazon, so I think in Ireland you can grab it on Amazon. You can run or walk with me or work out with me with the Audible. So I think you probably can access that in Ireland as well.
You can, yeah.
Okay. So those would be good places. I'm really grateful for everyone picking up the book and reading along. It's been out since February now, so it's 3 months old.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And only getting more people picking it up and spreading that message. As I said, it's amazing. Living a life of yay. And I know how much work and effort and blood, sweat and tears, for the lack of a better term, you've put into this based on your previous experience, based on the research that you did. So a massive thank you for me for writing it, because I know how much value it's going to provide people. And for everybody listening, I will link those in the show notes for today's episode. Go check out Megan on Instagram. Go check out the book. Megan, keep doing what you're doing. And thank you so much again.
Thank you. Yay.
So there you have it, Megan B. Murphy on recovering from an eating disorder, learning to say no, and living a fully charged life. Megan's positivity just blows through the screen. So I hope you enjoyed today's podcast as much as I enjoyed recording it. This is an awesome conversation with somebody who is putting out such a positive energy into the world. So go check out our book, go check out our Instagram page. And that is everything from today's episode. As always, if you enjoyed it, be sure to take a screenshot and pop it up on your Instagram story. You can tag me, Brian_Keen_Fitness. You can tag Megan B. Murphy. And if it's your first time listening, be sure to hit that follow button, hit that subscribe button for podcasts coming every single week. That's all from today's episode. Catch you all next Monday.